Hello, once again, welcome to the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Greyhawk.
And I'm your co-host, Jackson Eflin.
Thank you for joining us for episode 18 of our Disney bracket. This week, we will be discussing once again 1996's Hunchback of Notre Dame and 2012's Wreck-It Ralph.
The theme for this week is social outcasts and learning to accept your strengths and weaknesses.
Also, films that are a little outside Disney's usual fare.
And films that have sequels, sort of. Wreck-It Ralph technically I assume that the Wreck-It Ralph sequel is done, so it kind of has a sequel. It's just, like, not a sequel that's accessible yet.
It depends how many reshoots they do, considering how many people are losing their shit over the princesses interacting with one another.
Just kind of reshoots? That said, the princesses looks great. Other things happen in the trailers, but I really don't care. They're appealing to my nostalgia, and my nostalgia is giving in. Just inject it right into my veins. I want to see all these characters hanging out. We don't really have any good upbeat Disney nostalgia things that are focused on that part of Disney's canon that I can think of off the top of my head. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Let's look at what we said before about these movies. We talked about Hunchback. We asked how in the hell was it G-rated. We talked about how the use of the G slur was not great. And with that, it wasn't great that Esmeralda, who was otherwise a really great character, is played by Demi Moore, who, as far as we know, is not Romani in any way. We talked about how the animation is amazing. We talked about how there are big themes of justice happening here, but it's kind of undercut because of the Demi Moore casting and other issues with the film. Talk about how Frollo is a personification of rape culture and how the film uses heavy visual metaphors. Some of them were good, some of them not so good. Also, we talked about Esmeralda being sidelined in the climax. I feel like having rewatched it, it's a little unfair. She does wake up for the last bit and hold the Quasimodo to keep him from falling off the edge of Notre Dame. That's pretty good. I appreciate that.
Meanwhile, in episode 4 when we discussed Wreck-It Ralph, first I actually have a retraction I'd like to make. I stated in episode 4 that Wreck-It Ralph 2 would be the first theatrically released Disney sequel. That is not the case. The 1977 film The Rescuers had a theatrically released sequel, The Rescuers Down Under, that was released in 1990.
I get it though, The Rescuers are often kind of overlooked as part of Disney canon.
Mm-hmm. I'm not going to beat myself up about it too much. No one on Twitter complained, so. We talked about the contrasting but not clashing character designs of the main characters, especially because they come from completely different games. The really interesting relationship between Felix and Calhoun and some of the ways that they play around with gender stereotypes. We also talked about some of the problems with the Badenon support group and how it can lead to accepting injustice or just accepting your lot in life. How some of the themes of the film are a little muddied due to how complex the plot is. One of the big ones was Turbo and King Candy being the same person, and it's a little convoluted and probably not terribly necessary for the plot of the film. We talked about the surrogate fatherhood themes of Ralph and Vanellope and how they worked, how they didn't. How Sugar Rush has a lot of really great world building, but the other two games that were created whole cloth for the film don't really. We also discussed how this film feels very DreamWorks-y, partially because the point of view character that we have is a villain, at the beginning of the film at least.
Although actually, now that you mention it, Hunchback kind of feels a bit DreamWorks-y too at the time, in that it feels kind of like Prince of Egypt. And I mean, Prince of Egypt is a very different film than, say, Megamind, but that's kind of where DreamWorks was then.
Yeah, there's also just how heavily they lean into the musical structure of Hunchback. I think it's probably the film from the Renaissance that feels most like a stage musical.
I think I really love about it is how a lot of the songs flow one into the next.
I agree that it's well done. It's not really my thing, but I'm not a huge fan of musicals.
It is much better than the other Hunchback of Notre Dame musical, the one written by Victor Hugo.
Let's go ahead and jump into comparisons and contrasts, and probably the perfect place to start is our two leading men. It's actually really easy to draw parallels between Quasimodo and Ralph. They're both social outcasts. They're outcasts for very different reasons. Quasi is just kind of rejected due to his physical appearance and the circumstance of having his guardian be a colossal, lying, gaslighting jackass. Whereas Ralph actually has some character flaws along with social cast that are the reasons for his rejection from society.
And Ralph, much like Quasimodo, is physically aberrant. There is mention of his weirdly large hands.
Hey, why are your hands so freakishly big?
He's twice the size of all the other Nicelanders, etc.
He's often described as smelly by various individuals.
Yeah, which I love the recurring gag of.
Didn't hear you. Your breath is so bad it made my ears numb.
But yeah, he's ostracized more for his actions than for his physicality. It's hard to compare them because both have their place in their narratives. I think if Quasimodo were more villainous, it might muddy the themes of acceptance that the film's working. And he kind of has this whole, like, afflicted innocent thing as opposed to Ralph, who is more of a villain.
However, because of that, Quasi's not a terribly interesting character on his own. That's one of the reasons why he needs such a strong set of partners for the film in Esmeralda and Phoebus, and such a strong antagonist. Otherwise, I don't think the film would be nearly as interesting.
See, I'm going to kind of disagree with you a little bit. During this watch, I was really paying attention to how Quasimodo is very afraid of Frollo, is very sure that Frollo is right about him.
You are deformed.
I am deformed.
And you are ugly.
And I am ugly.
And these are crimes.
And how him coming to accept that Frollo is a monster is a really legit arc.
All my life you have told me that the world is a dark, cruel place, but now I see that the only thing dark and cruel about it is people like you.
It's not like super well handled. I think it's basically the same arc that we get from Rapunzel and Tangled, but I think he's still a fairly solid character. To be fair, he's also contrasted with Phoebus and Frollo and Esmeralda, who are all amazing characters.
So. Also, another interesting comparison, they both excel at climbing buildings.
These are both technically villain-centered narratives, ostensibly. Sure, Ralph isn't particularly villainous overall, but like he is the villain in his story, and The Hunchback of Notre Dame has traditionally been the villain in a lot of things. Like, he's one of the universal monsters, along with Dracula and the Wolfman, etc. He has generally been the monster up until basically now for a lot of stories.
I'd be lying if I didn't say I noticed similarities between Hunchback and Phantom of the Opera, in Disney's version anyway.
For sure. And there are also a bit of King Kong parallels with Quasimodo carrying Esmeralda up the tower. A little problematic, but also there's not really that many ways to climb a tower holding a maiden.
Especially with how built Quasi's upper body is and his hunched figure. I don't blame him too much.
Yeah. I like Quasimodo more, although I'm also a bit biased towards a person with a disfigurement. I understand why Ralph is a good character. He's well written and all that jazz. But I feel like I've seen this character before.
That's fair. Let's go ahead and jump into the main women in the cast.
Mm-hmm.
So we have Esmeralda compared and contrast with Vanellope.
Mm-hmm. I think I'll say about Hunchback, I wish there were more women. There's really just Esmeralda and I guess some background characters. Whereas you have, you know, decent range of women in Wreck-It Ralph. You've got Calhoun, you've got Vanellope, and you've also got various background characters who are different in their own ways.
Yeah, nice. You have the woman who bakes the cake for the Nicelanders. You have Taffeta and Candlehead, who are bullies to Vanellope. And then various female background characters.
And I like that Calhoun and Vanellope are very different characters.
One of the main actual human point of view characters for the film is the blonde girl playing the video games. Esmeralda and Vanellope also, again, are oddly similar with how they're shunned by society due to just the circumstance of their birth, so to speak. And they're treated about as poorly as one another. I mean, Vanellope probably doesn't have to worry about death necessarily, but almost everything else is on the table for her.
I think it's a little bit messy, though, with their persecution, because Vanellope has this sort of wrong noblewoman thing that at the end it all gets reset, and the prejudice towards glitches isn't really unpacked because she's a queen. The other racers don't have a moment of, oh, we accept you despite your glitch, or oh, we accept you because of your glitch. It's a moment of, we're sorry for bullying you now that you have power again. And while I think those two things are connected, it could have been handled more smoothly, I think, if they'd had a few more lines in there.
I get what you're saying, and I definitely see the problem of Vanellope going from this persecuted class to all of a sudden that's magicked away.
Mm-hmm. Although on the other hand, I think Vanellope gets to be more of a character. Like, she has like more character traits, whereas Esmeralda has to be a bit more pure in a lot of ways. She has to represent all of womanhood and a lot of ways, a lot of Romanihood in her narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And doesn't get to have as many traits, although the traits she does get are really great. Like, I love her constant focus on justice and supporting the downtrodden. I love that she's funny and witty. Her fight with Phoebus is amazing.
You fight almost as well as a man.
Funny. I was going to say the same thing about you.
So why don't we go ahead and get into our antagonists.
Mm.
Interestingly enough, I would argue that both these films have the same antagonist of authority. It's just the authority authority in Hunchback is concentrated into the character of Frollo and Frollo alone. Whereas in Wreck-It Ralph, you have the authority of the Nicelanders who have kicked Ralph to the dump and gentrified his former home. You have King Candy, who has usurped the throne from Vanellope.
You can also make the argument that the Cybugs are an antagonist, although they're more like a natural disaster than a villain.
They're used very similarly to zombies in cinema, and zombies are almost always used to portray either natural disasters or social movements.
Although, actually, we have a zombie who's a character in Wreck-It Ralph. Kind of. A little bit of a character. A little character.
He gets a few lines. That's more than some cameos.
I want to get into the cameos later, but right now I want to get into Frollo, and man, he's a really good villain. Ursula, Maleficent are villains I love. Frollo is dark. He's creepy and sinister and very specific in his sinisterness in a way that isn't just, I want to take over the kingdom. It's really upsetting, honestly.
Yeah. There's some similarities with him and Lady Tremaine from Cinderella, just how nasty and evil a vanilla human can be to another person. Just out of spite or hatred.
And that's kind of where I thought they were going to go with King Candy. And I think that him having a motivation of not wanting Vanellope to win the race because it would mess up his whole takeover thing reduces prejudice to a specific logical reason as opposed to just a irrational hatred. And while I understand that it makes for a good twist reveal, as it were, it also makes prejudice too simple.
I wouldn't even say he gets more unhinged than Frollo does. Towards the end of Hunchback, Frollo is just completely off the deep end. You can see it in his eyes and how red they are from his lack of sleep and just how erratic his usually very composed movements are.
There's a bit where he says,
"And he shall smite the wicked and plunge them into the fiery pit."
Basically, he's putting himself in the place of God, which is a lot. And admittedly, King Candy also does that. He edits the code and all that jazz, which is really scary as well. He, like, puts memories in a box. That's creepy. Because there's so much else happening, we don't get to really spend as much time with the awesome power that he has there.
There's also the fact that King Candy is always a little off throughout most of the film. Again, he has this Mad Hatter sort of vibe.
Oh yeah, that's a good... Yeah, he's very Mad Hatter-ish.
Alan Tudyk does a great job portraying that.
I'll lock you in my fun dungeon.
Fun dungeon?
Fun dungeon. You know, it's a play on words.
Mm. Also, Tony J does a phenomenal job with Frollo.
This is an unholy demon. I'm sending it back to hell where it belongs.
If you kind of want more of that Frollo thing but don't want to deal with Hunchback, if you check out the old reboot cartoon, he plays one of the main antagonists, Megabyte, and he does an excellent job there too.
He has this rich, chocolatey voice for it.
Wait between lashes. Otherwise, the old sting will dull him to the new.
It's very impressive.
Yeah, it very much reminds me of Christopher Lee.
The hour grows late, and Gandalf the Grey rides to Isengard.
Christopher Lee would have been a good Frollo. Looking beyond just the specific villains to the more like societal oppression level of things, I think we're kind of on pretty even footing here, where by the end of the film, both the crowd of Paris and the Nicelanders and the people of Sugar Rush all kind of accept these protagonists who they were very prejudicial towards before. It feels a bit too easy in both cases for me.
I don't want to say I'm not going to fault it, but I don't expect much. It's a Disney film.
It would take a lot of time and basically another character to really unpack both sides, so it doesn't bother me too much.
There's also the quote-unquote police in both films. We have the Donuts, who are ostensibly typical American police officers.
And I love their donuts. It's very good.
And then we have the town guards that Frollo uses to commit his atrocities.
There's like the two town guards who don't have helmets, and they get some lines, and everybody else is just stormtroopers.
Both sets of them are absolutely cruel for almost no reason. Perfect examples of this are in Hunchback, we have them harassing Esmeralda towards the beginning of the film, right before Phoebus steps in. And then with the guards in Wreck-It Ralph, Ralph is already captured and immobilized in a giant cupcake, but they still just beat him with their clubs. And I think it says a lot about how jaded the general populace is that this is in a Disney film and no one bats an eye at it. It's just, yeah, this is funny. This is how cops act.
It's fine. It's fine. this is fine. I do appreciate that the cops and Hunchback kind of get their own handed to them a bit by Phoebus. But yeah, it's weird that like the casual violence of the state isn't really unpacked. And like even at the end, I don't think that Vanellope really like banishes them for being cops.
Or, you know, restructures law enforcement.
Which, again, that would take, you know, more time to get into. But maybe Wreck-It Ralph 2 is about the dismantling of the carceral state. I do want to talk about our good guys, Phoebus and
Phoebus and Fix-It Felix Jr.
Yeah, say that three times fast.
Phoebus and Fix-It Felix Jr. Phoebus and Fix-It Felix Jr. Phoebus and Fix-It Felix Jr.
Yeah, so they're both the goodest boys, and I appreciate them. I think I like about Phoebus, I didn't notice the first time. When we first meet him, he sees Esmeralda and a few other of the Romani dancing, and he tosses some money in their hat, kind of out of hand. And then he sees Esmeralda, is like, dang, she's hot. He saw them as people first, and then he saw Esmeralda as, like, a romantic interest.
It's really interesting to see that the interest that Phoebus has grow not based off necessarily Esmeralda's looks, but her actions.
Her campaigning for justice, her beating him in a sword fight, her saving him from the river.
At one point, after a pretty impressive stunt from Esmeralda, he just goes,
what a woman.
Touching on Phoebus's horse Achilles just for a moment. If you at home are wondering where he ranks, where that horse ranks on the Disney horse bracket, right above Philippe from Beauty and the Beast and just below Khan from Mulan.
Yeah, he's pretty cool, but he doesn't ride up an avalanche. Meanwhile, Fix-It Felix, who is the purest of souls.
Such a great casting choice for his character too. I don't think anyone except Jack McBrayer could have done justice to that character.
I think the way that he decides to get into the plot because he knows it's his job to fix Ralph's messes, but he doesn't begrudge Ralph for that. He's never all that antagonistic towards Ralph. Makes me happy and it makes me appreciate him as a character.
He actually doesn't really get upset with Ralph until they meet up again in the Fungeon, and Ralph is asking him, hey, I need you to fix this go-kart.
Yeah, although to be fair, he's had a very bad day.
Yes.
I ran higgledy-piggledy all over creation looking for you. I almost drowned in chocolate milk mix. And then I met the most dynamite gal. Oh, she gives me the honey glow, something awful. But she rebuffed my affections. And then I got thrown in jail!
He works really well as a foil to Ralph because in any other movie he would have been the hero. In the way that a lot of things could have cast Phoebus as the hero. I think that works better with Phoebus because he starts off being not a fan of Frollo, but doing his job. Mm. And his eventual decision to refuse to burn down the house and then go rogue is really cool. And I think we said this before, we need more role models for people who were part of state violence rejecting it.
The actions that Frollo takes against the Romani are unfortunately incredibly topical in the United States' current debate about immigration. And I'm not going to lie, it's a little difficult to watch.
And while watching difficult things can be important, especially for having catharsis, it does mean it's kind of a sometimes food as opposed to an always times food.
I think that's always going to be the case with Hunchback. It's an incredibly dark film.
I dream that one day we will have a day where this is a thing of the past that is no longer culturally relevant. Maybe. Someday.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully. Speaking of cultural relevance, I like Wreck-It Ralph's cultural gags, but I'm wondering how well that will age over time.
I mean, most of the cameos are from video game characters and franchises that have remained somewhat relevant for 20 to 30 years. I mean, you've got Sonic the Hedgehog, Street Fighter has been around since the 80s. Probably earlier than that, but I mean, Street Fighter got its own movie. You've got references to Pong, Pac-Man. These are some of the forefathers of video gaming, and video games in a medium are probably going to be sticking around. I think that they are going to remain culturally relevant for quite a long time, just as much as something like Nosferatu or Charlie Chaplin. At least two of the games Disney actually created. Like, you can go online and play Fix-It Felix Jr. in your browser right now. I actually think we have a link to it on our Facebook page. Disney also created a Unity-based game of Sugar Rush and had about 9 to 12 playable characters and I think 1 or 2 tracks. Unfortunately, you can't find it online anymore. And it's only been 6 years. There's a lot of discussion right now about preservation of video game history, and it's, I think what happened with Disney's Sugar Rush game is kind of endemic of that. It's incredibly difficult to find. It's only been 6 years, especially since they're having a sequel come out. You'd think that they would probably be putting that back up somewhere.
Rounding out the cultural reference gags, I appreciate that there's a bit in Hunchback where Laverne the Gargoyle is sending a bunch of pigeons after some guards and she shouts,
"Fly, my pretties, fly!"
And it has the music from Wizard of Oz, which, wow, that I didn't know you could do that. That's MGM's.
I think at this point, Disney's proves that if they want it, they will spend the money to get it.
Oh boy, the trailers for Wreck-It Ralph 2 want you to know that. Wreck-It Ralph feels a bit more commercial than Hunchback, which for all its flaws, it feels very much like a passion project. It feels like they really wanted to tell this story and they wanted to tackle these issues, even if they didn't tackle them all that well. And I appreciate that.
I think part of the reason that Wreck-It Ralph feels so commercial, besides the fact that it's more modern Disney and that's just kind of where Disney's at right now, is the fact that video games in and of themselves are incredibly commercial. Art video games exist, but they're not very widely played or distributed. There isn't a really solid video game awards to kind of push the envelope for artistry like the Oscars do. I mean, there are problems with the Oscars, don't get me wrong, but they do push the medium of film forward. There's not really anything like that for video games except for the consumer market.
This is a small thing, but I appreciate that Frollo's going around looking for Esmeralda and, by extension, the other Romani. And the first time, he offers 10 pieces of silver to somebody. The second time, he offers 20 pieces of silver. The third time, he doesn't get a chance to make the offer because he burns down the house. But I like that they were subtly referencing the whole 30 pieces of silver from the Bible without hitting over the head with it. You can tell the creators really wanted to do the thing from the book where Frollo is an evil priest, but Disney was like, oh, no, 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 no. So they just came as close as they could to it. By that token, I really appreciate that they split the character of Frollo into the judge and the deacon. Having this moral center who doesn't have a lot to do in the film but is still present and has narrative weight is a really good idea to make the world feel not quite as grimdark.
The deacon, who is played by David Ogden Stiers, kind of acts like Frollo's conscience in a way, although he is outside of Frollo and thus can interact with a few other characters like, I believe, Phoebus and Esmeralda. Although I'm a little disappointed that we don't get a scene with him and Quasimodo, because I think that would have been really interesting.
Yeah, that is really weird. I mean, they live in the same house.
There's a couple things I wanted to touch on in Wreck-It Ralph. So this time I noticed and was a little uncomfortable with the size of Calhoun's bust. There's this scene with her and Felix right before they enter Sugar Rush, and the way the shot is framed, it just kind of accentuates that a lot.
Especially with the way her bust is twice the width of her waist.
And I'm not sure whether it was kind of just attempting to make this sexy lady, or whether it was specifically done to critique the shallow supermodel body types often found in video games to appeal to a adult male audience.
I appreciate that Fictive Felix doesn't do like a hard eyes humana 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 thing. He's more into her because she slaps him and he's a sub, probably. We had a long conversation about exactly how their BDSM works. Anyway, it could have made it much worse, but you're not wrong. It is kind of weird and it doesn't really get unpacked at all.
I'm not too concerned about it considering how many other ways that they avert gender stereotypes with Calhoun. I mean, you have this sort of stereotype of this badass female who is tougher than all the men and doesn't show emotion. But then she also has this huge trauma in her backstory, and there's actually a really great depiction of exactly what a trigger is in this film when Felix first refers to Calhoun as a dynamite gal.
You are one dynamite gal.
One dynamite gal. Dynamite gal. Dynamite gal. Dynamite gal.
It's a really good scene, although because of how much else happened in this movie, I don't know if we get as much of a resolution for that as we could. We know that Felix and Calhoun get married at the end and it's sweet, but I wouldn't have minded like one more scene where they unpack Calhoun's trauma or see more of her being able to work past it. I know it's kind of like the stuff with the, there isn't necessarily a good time or a place for it in the plot. Mm-hmm. But I think that could have been something that might have been more smoothly done beyond just woman gets over trauma by getting married. I know it's not quite what they had in mind, but that's tactically what happens.
You'd have space for a lot more of this if you dropped the whole Turbo subplot.
It feels so needless looking back on it. Like, it's just sort of a very obvious, like, should have been left on the script floor.
Mm-hmm. And they don't really set up that mystery. They mention going turbo 4 times, but that's about it. They don't set up this mystery of what happened to Turbo. Everyone's like, oh, well, he invaded this other person's game and they both got unplugged, and everyone assumed that was sort of the end of it. There are no rumors that he survived or whatnot, and they don't really place a whole lot of clues into King Candy that he's supposed to be Turbo. There's not like a clue when he is fiddling with the code that he is in fact Turbo.
There is some good foreshadowing that Vanellope is a princess. There is a bit where she talks about how she can feel like racing's in her code, and there's a point where she has Ralph kneel down as she bestows an honor upon him the way that royalty often does. That's pretty good.
I also do appreciate this film for kind of pointing out the ridiculousness of pull yourself up by your bootstraps mentality. You can see it with Vanellope and the race to be one of the daily racers for Sugar Rush. So in order to enter that race, you have to have coins from previous winnings, but you have to earn those coins by racing. So Vanellope can't race, she can't earn that coin, so she can't race.
Although on the flip side, we talked a little bit about this before, how there's underlying themes of staying in your place, and like going turbo is still a problem that, you know, people don't really talk about, like the, oh, it's turned out well that you went turbo this time with Ralph and Felix and Calhoun, etc. And so while it does do a good job picking up the problems of bootstrap mentality, it doesn't quite dig into all the ways that systems fail people and need to be uprooted. Although, I don't know, sequels.
We've been discussing things for a little while now. I think it's time to render our votes.
Mm-hmm. I lean more towards Hunchback, but I think they're both very good. It's just that Hunchback strikes chords that I want struck more than Wreck-It Ralph does.
Going into this episode, I thought I was going to be voting for Wreck-It Ralph at the end. But discussing it more, I think that Hunchback has fewer flaws than Wreck-It Ralph. The narrative structure of Wreck-It Ralph is very complicated, and I think there could have been stuff done to trim some of the fat and put in more character-driven stuff, especially with Calhoun and Felix and maybe even Vanellope as well. That isn't to say that Wreck-It Ralph is a bad film. It's still a really great film and one of the first actually good films about video games. It is going to be one of the few movies that gets a theatrical Disney sequel. It had to have done something right.
So in Wreck-It Ralph, if you haven't seen it or haven't seen it recently, how Sugar Rush works is that every night all the racers go on a race and the top 9 people get to be the player characters the next day. I think if, you know, we took all the moves on our list, Ralph would definitely be in the top 9 who get to race. It's a really good movie, but I think there's just a few ways in which Hunchback pushes ahead. That said, they're really close, so we're gonna put up polls on Facebook and Twitter. Tell us what you think, and if you disagree, cool. Hunchback is still going to move on, but maybe we'll start a conversation.
So that does it for us this week. Next week, we are going to be talking about The Jungle Book and Beauty and the Beast. This is going to be a lot different than our first 2 matches we've had for round 2.
Mm-hmm.
These films are very different.
Yes.
I think it's going to be difficult for us to draw some similarities between them. Although they both have had recent live-action adaptations, so there's that quote-unquote live-action for Jungle Book.
There's a living child in it. He's trapped in a virtual world and trying to escape, but he's being eaten. It's basically Jumanji 2 Welcome to the Jungle, only with like a small newcomer as opposed to Rock the Dwayne Johnson and other people. Like Karen Gillan, Kevin Hart, and Jack Black, who are all great. And Zac Efron? No.
He's one of the Jonas Brothers.
One of the Jonas Brothers.
Anyway, thank you for joining us this week. We hope you tune in next Friday for episode 19. If you want to make sure to be alerted when that goes up, you can follow us on Podbean or on Facebook or on Twitter, and we will post links when the episode goes live. Once again, this has been the Gratuitous Pausing Podcast. We hope you tune in next time.